Om sahanavavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shantihi. Om, very good. There you are. Welcome to all of you. And welcome also to our many students watching these classes online. We'll continue our study of chapter 13 today. Just checking. Yeah, that's in good shape. And we'll begin with recitation. Excuse me. Beginning with verse 8. And as always, as I'm chanting, be sure to read the translation and then repeat after me. Amanitvam adambhitvam, amanitvam adambhitvam, ahimsa kshantirajavam, ahimsa kshantirajavam, acharyopasanam shaucham, acharyopasanam shaucham, Staryam atma vinigraha, indriyarteshu vairagyam, anahankara hevacha, janma mrityu jara vyadhi, janma mrityu jara vyadhi, dukkha doshanu darshanam, asaktirana bhishvangaha, putradara graharishu, nityan cha samachittatvam, ishta nishtopapattishu, mai chananya yogena, bhaktiravya vicharini, vivikta desha sevitvam, aratir jana samsari, adhyatma jnana nityatvam, adhyatma jnana nityatvam, tatvajnanartha darshanam, etadjnanamiti proktam, ajnanam yaratonyatha, ajnanam yaratonyatha, jneyam yattat pravakshyami, jneyam yattat pravakshyami yadnyatvamritam ashnute anarimat nasattannasaruchyate. Very good. Let us pick up the thread in the last class. We spent quite a while introducing this topic and discussing verse 8. Remember that the chapter 13 begins with Arjuna's three sets of two questions. One set of questions, what is jnanam and what is jnayam? What is jnanam? What is knowledge? What is jnayam? That which is to be known. And we'll see later, what is jnayam, to be known, is Brahman, absolute reality, the reality of the cosmos, the reality of you, the reality because of which the cosmos exists and the reality because of which you exist can't be different. That is jnayam. We'll come to that topic next. What is to be known? Brahman.
then jnanam is the means of gaining that knowledge. And that was our main discussion in our previous class, and that is to gain this extraordinary knowledge, knowledge of Brahman, is going to require extraordinary preparation. To gain extraordinary knowledge, you must be extraordinarily prepared. In Vedanta, we use the word adhikaritvam, not in any Hindi meaning, but in the meaning of preparedness. Adhikaritvam, preparedness, but specifically preparedness for this wisdom, for brahmajnanam, knowledge of Brahman, atmajnanam, knowledge of your own true self. So for this extraordinary knowledge, the extraordinary preparation is given here. It's called jnanam by Sri Krishna, and he gives it as a series of 20 values. We saw the first of those values in our last class, amanatvam and adambatvam, freedom from pride and pretension, ahimsa, harmlessness, kshantihi, patience, arjavam, straightforwardness, acharya, upasanam, reverence to a teacher, shaucham, cleanliness, sthariyam, firmness, and atma vinigraha, self-control. So we saw those first nine of the 20 values in the prior class. And before we move on, there was one question about how the third value here is ahimsa. So the question is, how can Sri Krishna be preaching ahimsa here when he keeps telling Arjuna to get up and fight? It seems contradictory, and it seems contradictory if you missed the first class. In our I think it was our first class or maybe our second class that we discussed that there are many times when some himsa is, himsa means harm. Ahimsa means harmlessness. There are many situations in which some himsa is required to prevent a greater harm. You might remember the metaphor I gave long ago. In a hospital room, a doctor will take a scalpel, cut you open from here to here, peel open. They do this regularly. They use a big clamp. They peel open your flesh. They use a saw and saw right up your breastbone. Then they crack that open. Do you think that hurts? Of course, you're under anesthesia, but is it harmful to a person's body? Tremendous trauma caused by open heart surgery. But you all understand very well that surgery is done to prevent a greater harm, death from a heart attack. So that's a very simple example to show why Sri Krishna encourages Arjuna to go and fight this war. It's harm, of course. Any war is harmful. But in this particular case, as we discussed at length in that first class or second class, I don't remember, this was a war fighting which prevented a greater harm. We won't get into the details of it. If you're unclear about it, go back and review that first or second class. All these classes are available online, as you know. Okay. We won't go further on that. So, having seen the first nine values in this first verse, we now see the remainder of the 20 values, starting with verse 9. Indriyarteshu vairagyam, indriyarteshu vairagyam, anahankara hevacha, anahankara hevacha, janma mrityujara vyadhi, janma mrityujara vyadhi, dukkha doshanu darshanam, dukkha doshanu darshanam. Next, the 10th of the 20 values, indriyarteshu vairagyam. Vairagyam means dispassion, the state of having viraga, dispassion. And dispassion towards what? Indriya arteshu, objects of the senses. Everything that's desirable around us in the world, dispassion towards sense objects, towards sense pleasures, the pleasures that we find in the world. Notice he says dispassion. He doesn't say hating. Many people misinterpret vairagya. Oh, you have to hate the world. He doesn't say hating the world. He says dispassion, absence of passion. And my guru would say it's objectivity. He loved to talk about this. It is being objective towards the world. But objectivity means understanding that all worldly pleasures are finite and fleeting. To focus your whole life on gaining these finite and fleeting pleasures when you could be pursuing the true source of happiness, contentment, and peace within you. He would say if you're fixated on going to Starbucks, and notice I used the word fixated, if you are passionate about your coffee, he would be, my guru is puzzled by that kind of worldly response, because why are you so focused on a cup of coffee which you enjoy for just a few minutes when you could be pursuing the true source of contentment and peace within you, having discovered which you enjoy a contentment which is not fleeting. You enjoy inner peace which continues for the remainder of your life. So in his perspective, why are you wasting your time with all these external pursuits when you could be focused on the true self, Satchidananda Atma? Notice then, it's a perspective. Dispassion here doesn't mean hating the world. Many people misinterpret Hinduism. In fact, Western scholars, especially when they started studying Hindu traditions, they accused Hinduism as being a world-negating religion. That's an expression that was used by many Western scholars. Hinduism is a world-negating religion, not true at all. This is a religion of objectivity. Whatever you can enjoy in the world, go ahead and enjoy it, but how much pleasure is there in that Starbucks coffee? There is some pleasure. Absolutely, there's some pleasure in that. But how much? And for how long? And when you compare that to the lasting fullness and completeness which you can gain through spiritual growth, making that comparison is objectivity. So here, vairagya, dispassion, is born of clear thinking, objective thinking. So that's our 10th value, indriyarteshu. Vairagyam, dispassion towards sense objects, complete objectivity about the limitations of what you can achieve through worldly pursuits. You can achieve much, but whatever you perceive is limited and fleeting. Then, next of our values, anahankaraha. And here ahankara has a conventional meaning of ego or pride. So anahankara, absence of ego, egoity, absence of pride. And it's not difficult to... You could turn it around and say, many people find it easy to be prideful and boastful. I find it very easy to be humble, because all you have to do is reflect on the fact that whatever you possess, whatever skills you have, whatever accomplishments you've accomplished, you've gotten all that with the help of so many others. where would you be, right, to make the obvious one, where would you be without your parents? You wouldn't be born. But not only being born, but the values and teachings your parents imparted to you. Then later, when you were in school and college, all of those teachers who imparted so much knowledge to you, many of you have built great careers based on the knowledge that was imparted to you. You didn't invent that knowledge. You didn't even learn it on your own. You were taught all of that. And then in professional life, whatever you do, whatever you accomplish, you receive so much support from hundreds and thousands of outside sources. So there's a nice English saying that if you rise high, you do so standing upon the shoulders of those who have come before you. Nicely said. So maybe we should kind of remember that we're standing on those shoulders, and simply to acknowledge that fact removes pride, removes this exaggerated sense of self-worth. Oh, yeah. You have to pardon me. When I talk about my guru, Pujaswami Dayananda, it brings back certain memories. And one time he was talking about this, not I don't know about this verse, but this topic of pride and ego. And he called the ego, this is his exact expression. I still he used this back in the 1980s. So I remember it after all these years. He said, ego is a big, bloated bladder of bluffs. That was his expression. Yeah, a big, bloated bladder of bluffs. So who needs it? Okay, that is ahankara. Here the value is anahankara, absence of that exaggerated sense of self-importance. The 12th of the 20 values, janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, dukkha, doshanu, darshanam. That's actually one word, one long compound word. Start at the end. It is the anudarshanam, reflection. Reflection means in a mental sense, mental, not like light reflecting on a mirror, thinking about something, considering. So mental reflection about the dosha, here defects, the defects of dukkha, suffering. So reflection on the defects of suffering, and what are those, what kind of suffering? Suffering like, and now beginning of the compound, janma, suffering associated with being born. Babies are born laughing or crying? Right? Okay, so suffering begins with your first breath. I'm not saying life is all suffering, just pointing out the fact that with our first breath, our suffering begins. Janma, and the suffering continues until mrityu. Death, janma, mrityu, and in between birth and death is what? Jara, old age, and vyadhi, illness. So you suffer with birth, then you have illness and old age and death. This is not to be world-negating. We're being objective here. No one gets through life without suffering. Suffering is a fact of life. And there's nothing we can do to avoid the physical and psychological elements of suffering. That's built in. If you have a physical body, you're subject to pain. If you have a mind, you're subject to sadness. no choice. If you have a body, you're subject to pain. If you have a mind, you're subject to sadness. If you don't want to experience pain or sadness, you shouldn't have a body or mind. That's not a very good solution. Vedanta gives you a solution. Vedanta helps you to discover how you are okay in spite of the pain in your body. You are okay in spite of the sadness in your mind. Pain in your body is a fact and not a problem if you have discovered the fact that it doesn't truly affect you. Your true nature, as Satchidananda Atma, remains absolutely unaffected by the pain in your body. In the same way, your true nature as Satchidananda Atma remains utterly unaffected by the sadness in your mind. We've had this discussion several times. Sadness is not your enemy. People conclude, sadness is the enemy. If sadness is the enemy, why do you like sad movies? That doesn't make any sense, right? You like sad movies. Sadness is not the enemy. Sadness is not the problem, nor is pain the problem. Pain is a fact of life. Sadness is a fact of life when these teachings of Vedanta have lifted you up to a perspective to where you can see that you are absolutely okay in the presence of pain, in the presence of sadness. But here, the value is the anudarshanam, the mental reflection on dukkha dosha, on the problem of suffering, the problem of suffering that begins with birth and ends with death. The pain of the body is inevitable. The sadness in the mind is inevitable. So if you want to be content and at peace in this life, you better find a way to deal with the pain and sadness. Isn't that obvious? Most people spend a lifetime avoiding pain and sadness. And that's fine. Of course, whatever we can do in our life to minimize physical pain and sadness, absolutely we should do as much as we can. But if many people labor under the assumption that their goal of life is to minimize pain and minimize sadness. That's conventional thinking. Let me live in such a way that I can minimize pain and sadness. Absolutely conventional thinking. Nothing wrong with it, except for the fact that can you ever avoid pain and sadness? You can minimize it, fine. You can't avoid it. So therefore, you better find a way to deal with it. And to deal with it specifically in the way of that Vedanta enables you, and that is to help you discover how you are absolutely okay even in the presence of pain and sadness. And these Vedantic teachings are powerful enough to lead you to understand how you are absolutely okay, even in the presence of physical pain and sadness. Okay, let's see. Next.
Asaktiranabhishwangaha, asaktiranabhishwangaha, putradaragraharishu, putradaragraharishu, nityancha samachittatvam, nityancha samachittatvam, ishtanishtopapattishu, ishtanishtopapattishu. Asaktihi and anabhishwangaha have almost the same meaning. Asaktihi is not having sakti, attachment.
asaktihi, non-attachment. And unabhishwangaha, shwanga is embracing or clinging or grasping. Unabhishwangaha, absence of clinging and grasping. So anasaktihi, non-attachment, and unabhishwangaha, very similar, non-attachment and not clinging. And these words are used to describe a particular emotional problem with regard to, next line, with regard to putra, your children, dara, your spouse, griha, your house, adi, etc. With regard to children, spouse, house, etc., these two problems come up regularly. Attachment and clinging. Attachment and clinging both refer to, in English, the best expression, I think, to use to describe this problem is one of emotional dependence. When you speak of clinging to someone or something, when you speak of attachment to someone or something, what does that mean? Those words are a little bit abstract. Clinging, not in a physical sense, but emotional clinging, emotional attachment. Call it for what it is. Emotional dependence. That's what it is. And that's what's the problem. And this leads us to a discussion we've had here many times, and we're going to have one more time because it's such an important topic, and that is loving your children doesn't mean that they should do what you want them to. loving your adult children doesn't mean that they should do what you want them to. That's when you want your adult children to have a certain career or a certain spouse or live in a certain place, you want the best for them. Absolutely true. You want the best for them. But who is the ultimate beneficiary of them choosing what you want? It's for your sake, right? You say, you know, it's genuinely for their sake. I get that part. You want them to excel. But a great example is when your adult child wants this career path, you want them to take that career path, and it becomes a source of conflict, and sometimes big conflict, especially when it comes to spouse. Your adult child wants to marry him or her, and you say, oh my God, how can you even consider that? And, you know, I'm glad we can laugh about it. In some families, this becomes a horrible, horrible problem. It tears apart the families. So look at this. When you want, your adult son or daughter says, doing this will make me happy. You want them to do something else. Consider that. They say, doing this will make me happy. You want them to do something else because it'll make you happy. What has that got to do with love? That's not love at all. That is, sorry to use a strong word, that's selfishness. That's self-interest. The parent is insisting on their happiness being more important than their child's happiness. Of course, now the typical defense, the parent says, yes, but I know better. I know better than my son and daughter thinks that'll make them happy, but I know it won't. In my supreme wisdom, sorry, I'm going to be a little sarcastic here. In my supreme wisdom, I know what will make my adult son or daughter happy. I know better than they know. How does that sound? Little arrogant? Little misguided? Okay, you get the point. I mean, it's not uncommon for a parent to defend their position with that kind of response, but it's to use the American expression, it's totally lame. This is the problem of asakti, attachment, and abhishwanga, clinging. Or to use very simple terms, emotional dependence. The parent's happiness, this parent's sense of emotional well-being is dependent on their adult son or daughter doing what they want. This is not, clearly, it's not love. This is emotional dependence. It is a huge problem. So it occurs with regard to putra, your son or daughter. It occurs with regard to dara, your wife, literally spouse, literally wife, but in a more general sense, spouse. It includes your house. Many people have this attachment to their houses. You need shelter, but the I don't know. You may not have this problem, but some people are fixated in having the biggest house or the most nicely decorated house. There's some emotional need that's being fulfilled through the house, right? That's why griha is included here, adi, etc. How about profession? Isn't it common to be emotionally attached to success in your chosen profession? How many people are tremendously emotionally invested in their professions? That's not duty. You know, they'll say, I'm doing my duty. I'm going to work, taking care of my family, building my profession. Nonsense. It's not driven by a sense of duty. It's driven by a sense of emotional dependence, attachment, wanting to gain emotional fulfillment through your work. And now let's just summarize this. If you seek emotional satisfaction through your children, through your spouse, through your house, through your profession, through anything at all, when your emotional satisfaction depends on externals, what is the consequence? What happens when, you know, no matter how much your children love you, they're not going to necessarily do everything you want. No matter how much your spouse loves you, they're not likely to do everything you want. And no matter how much you love your profession, it's not necessarily the case that it's going to turn out the way you want. When your emotional well-being depends on others, you're in trouble. You're in a state of emotional dependence. It makes you vulnerable to hurt, sadness, depression, etc., etc., etc. What is the solution? The solution is, here's another, let's be careful here. The solution is not to be without emotions, to be emotionless. Some people think that they have to be strong and shake off all these weak emotions and not be affected by emotions. When we speak of being unemotional, I'm reminded in the 1960s, there was that Star Trek that was so popular with that character called Spock. Spock was a character who was half human and half Vulcan, whatever that meant. And one of his characteristics was he had no emotions, just absolutely no emotion. In one episode, his dear friend, the captain, is dying. And Spock says to his captain, his beloved captain, "Captain, I estimate in 33 seconds you will die." Emotionless. Is that desirable? Now, all that we've just discussed shows the difficulties of emotions. But is a solution the absence of emotion? Could you live a life like the Spock character, just being so emotionally disconnected to the extent that whatever happened to your spouse or children, koi baat nahi, who cares, doesn't make any difference. That kind of cold-hearted indifference is to be inhuman. And obviously, being inhuman is not the right direction. Do you think enlightened mahatmas, great souls, do they have emotions or not? Of course. You don't imagine a great person as being is compassion an emotion? Sure it is. So can you imagine a great enlightened person having no compassion at all? You come to this great, great enlightened person, you fall at the feet, "Oh, I'm suffering so much, please help me, please help me, please help me." And this enlightened person doesn't even acknowledge you. No compassion. That's obviously not how we understand an enlightened person. We understand an enlightened person to have emotions. To have emotions without being afflicted by the emotions. And this is it. This is what we're after. Emotions are not the problem. We said before, if you have a body, you'll have pain. If you have a mind, you'll have sadness. If you have a mind, you'll have all kinds of emotions. Comes with the territory, as they say. So the problem is, just as we said before, the problem is not physical pain. The problem is not sadness, nor is the problem these emotions. What is the problem? Well, we spoke quite a bit about emotional dependence. The problem is not the emotion part. The problem is the dependence part. Suppose you could have emotions without the dependence. Cool. That solves the problem. If you can love your children without having your emotional well-being dependent on them. If you can love your spouse, if you can love your house, if you can love your profession without feeling a sense of being dependent, without needing to get gratification from the house, the profession, and the loved ones in your life. The problem is not the emotion. The problem is the dependent. And how do you solve the problem of dependence? That brings us right back to Vedanta. When you can discover that your true nature is so full and complete that you don't need anything, that discovery frees you from dependence. And it has to be discovered. This is not something you can just believe in. This is not something you can just intellectually appreciate. This has to be personally discovered. When you can discover that you are innately full and complete, just as you are. How many times have you heard, you've heard this expression, inner divinity, inner divinity, inner divinity? That inner divinity is an already existent fact. Unfortunately, it's a truth that often goes unrecognized. So that inner divinity is somehow present and unrecognized by you. When you discover for yourself that inner divinity, when you discover that you are already incredibly blessed, infinitely blessed, if you discover that you are infinitely blessed, what will you depend on for the sake of happiness? You get this? If you discover you are infinitely blessed and your adult child marries someone you think is not the right person, you're still infinitely blessed. If you lose your job, you're still infinitely blessed. If your house burns down, you're still infinitely blessed. And that term infinite blessing suggests that nothing can rob you of your contentment and inner peace. This is the solution to the problem of dependence. When you discover your true divine nature, when you discover that you are infinitely blessed beyond measure, then nothing can rob you of your contentment and peace. Then what are you dependent upon for contentment and peace? Nothing at all. Okay. Continuing. Nityancha samachittatvam. Chitta, mind, samachitta, a mind that's in a state of equanimity. Samachittatvam is a state of equanimity, which is nityam, consistent. A consistent equanimity, unshakable equanimity. And unshakable equanimity means no matter what happens. We gave the example of your house burning down. So here, in the next line, he says you should have, the value here is having persistent equanimity when ishta anishta upapattishu. Upapattishu, when different things happen. When things happen that are ishta, desirable, or anishta, undesirable. Of course, it's easy to be okay when things are going well, when you get what you want. But when things go badly, to have equanimity when things go badly, what would be required to... In our last week's class, we pointed out that these values have to be cultivated. You're not born with them. They have to be learned. They have to be developed. They have to be cultivated. So how to cultivate this value of samachittatvam, of equanimity, how to cultivate the value of equanimity, how to be unshaken at times of catastrophe. And we've all been there, right? We've all been through some pretty tough times in life. And I don't want to sound too grim, but there are more tough times ahead. Is it? It's true, right? So what do we need to have the resiliency to handle those looming catastrophes? Again, I don't want to sound too dark, but this is a fact of life. Catastrophes lie in all of our futures. Are we ready to deal with that? Do you have the inner resiliency so that you are not shaken when things go badly, when things go wrong? Well, that has to be cultivated. How? Sri Krishna explains in the next verse, but I'll tell you what it is right now. One of the most important reasons for developing a prayer life and some kind of meaningful personal relationship with Bhagavan, God, is that prayer life can give you that resiliency more than anything else. So, to answer my question, how can you cultivate this equanimity that prevails no matter how badly things go? The answer, in a word, is bhakti. And we'll see that in the next verse. Before we go there, we've had this discussion in a very different context. Long ago, when we were talking about karma yoga, we said karma yoga is a big topic with lots of different aspects, but a main aspect of karma yoga is to recognize Ishvara, God, as karma pala data, as the giver of the results of our deeds. And deeds we've committed not just in this life, but in an infinite series of prior lives. To understand Ishvara as karma paladatta and to understand that whatever unfolds in our lives is a result not only of our current choices and deeds, but also the result of past karmas from past lifetimes. This understanding is what gives you the resiliency. How many times people go through a tragedy and the most common response, why me? Right? Why me? I'm a good person. I don't deserve this. That's all true. You are a good person. And it's also true, you don't deserve this based on your deeds in this lifetime. Absolutely true. You're a good person, and you absolutely don't deserve this based on your deeds in this lifetime. You can see where that goes, right? Not in this lifetime, but each of us as human beings come into this life with, we'll call it karmic baggage. How's that? We come with karmic baggage, which means we come with karmas that guarantee, actually two things. The karmas we're born with from past lives guarantee that good things will happen to us that we don't deserve based on our deeds in this life, right? Have good things happened to you that you didn't deserve, that you didn't work for? Absolutely. Based on our past karmas, we are all guaranteed to receive good things in this life that we absolutely don't deserve based on our deeds in this life. On the other hand, each of us are also guaranteed to undergo suffering in this life that we don't deserve based on our deeds in this life, according to karmas that we've had from past lives. You see how an understanding of the doctrine of karma and a relationship with Ishvara, the giver of the fruits of our deeds, these two factors will give you the resiliency to deal with catastrophes in life. In fact, without some kind of bhakti, and without some kind of understanding of the doctrine of karma, I think it's inevitable that people who suffer catastrophes, they will ask, why me? I don't deserve this. And the sad thing is that they're already suffering so much because of the catastrophe, and then piled on top of that suffering is another layer of suffering. That second layer of suffering is, why me? If you're going to go through a catastrophe, it would be a whole lot easier if you weren't burdened with that additional layer of suffering, why me? That resentment. I don't deserve this. That resistance and resentment pushes away any possibility of graceful acceptance. Graceful acceptance of the inevitability of certain things happening in life. If you can find that graceful acceptance, the amount of suffering is greatly reduced. And to gain that graceful acceptance, we need these two factors: some kind of bhakti and some kind of understanding of the doctrine of karma. And with that, Sri Krishna then turns to bhakti as the next of the values. Let's see that. Mayi chananya yogena, mayi chananya yogena, bhaktiravyabhicharani, bhaktiravyabhicharani, vivikta desha sevitvam, vivikta desha sevitvam, aratir jana samsari, aratir jana samsari. So not surprisingly, the next value in the second line is bhaktihi, devotion. Devotion unto whom? Sri Krishna says, mayi, to me. Devotion unto me. What kind of bhakti? Ananya yogena, a bhakti which is focused exclusively on, Sri Krishna says exclusively on me, but he's the one teaching this. So in another context, it doesn't, I guess the point I want to make is, let us not be sectarian in our interpretation of the scripture. Here Sri Krishna speaks not as an individual incarnation of Lord Vishnu. Sri Krishna speaking as Bhagavan in general. So when he says, devotion unto me, single-minded ananya yoga, single-minded devotion unto me, he's not suggesting that you should be focused on Sri Krishna and no other aspect of God, no other deity. He means to be focused on Bhagavan, Ishvara, to be focused on God in any manner that you choose. This is one of the glories of the Hindu tradition, and that is you get to choose which aspect of Ishvara becomes the focal point of your prayer lives. Many of you raised in a Hindu family will take that for granted. I don't take it for granted at all. So most religions, you don't get any choice. This is the form of God we worship. These are the prayers we use. This is the scripture, and this is it. And you have to do this, and you have to do this only. The Hindu tradition is so unlike that. In that it gives you choice, it gives you the freedom to find devotional practices and a devotional focus that works for you. And that's the uniqueness here. So this bhakti, bhakti which is avyabhicharani. Vyabhichara is wavering. Avyabhicharani bhakti is bhakti that doesn't waver, bhakti that doesn't come and go. Remember I told you my guru's joke? I think you all remember it. He talked about the person who comes in front of the temple and tears are falling from the eyes. They stretch out, they do the shashtanga namaskara, and they're just overwhelmed with devotion, and then they walk out the temple and it's gone. Just as quickly as that devotion came, the devotion left. They had, in my guru's word, that they had a spasm of devotion, making the person a spasmodic devotee. His term. So, avyabhicharani is the opposite of that spasmodic devotion. Notice that spasm of devotion, by the way, this is not to criticize it, it's emotion. And it's a wonderful emotion. But one thing we know about emotions, they're all what a funny way of putting it, all emotions are spasmodic, right? They come and go. They can come in a, you can have a spasm of happiness, then it goes. You can have a spasm of sadness, it goes. Spasm of anger, and then it goes. Spasm of devotion, then it goes. Anything based on an emotion comes and goes. Therefore, avyabhicharani bhakti, this is interesting to reflect on this, is Sri Krishna saying that you should have an unchanging emotion of loving God. You spend your whole day, just everything you do and say, you're always filled with love and devotion for God. No doubt some saints could live like that, but conventionally speaking, we don't. We don't live like that. So, the bhakti Sri Krishna describes here is not bhakti based merely on emotion. Emotion is crucial. Absolutely, that bhakti bhava, that feeling of closeness, that feeling of connection to Ishvara is such an important feeling that's meant to be cultivated. But when Sri Krishna is talking about avyabhicharani bhakti, he's talking about a bhakti that doesn't depend exclusively on emotion. That should make sense because we just got done studying the middle six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita focused on bhakti, and we saw in chapters 9 and 10, and starting in chapter 7, then chapter 9, then chapter 10, we saw so much emphasis, even though the main topic was bhakti, we saw so much emphasis on knowledge of Ishvara. Not merely an emotional connection to Ishvara, but knowledge, understanding, knowing who and what Ishvara is. That knowledge is unshakable. Remember, I pointed this out before. I said, no matter how chaotic things become in life, will you ever have any doubt that 2 + 2 = 4? 2 + 2 = 4 is knowledge, and it's unshakable, unwavering. And that's the kind of bhakti Sri Krishna is talking about, an unwavering bhakti that doesn't depend merely on emotions. This bhakti can be cultivated, and a tradition that gives you so many choices in terms of devotional practices, prayers. You can do kirtan, bhajan, you can do puja, you can do homa, havan. How many ways of all the festivals that are celebrated. I don't mean to be... Don't mistake me, but it just strikes me that the Hindu tradition is unusually rich with opportunities for developing bhakti, and in my opinion, much more so than any other religious tradition. I think it's extraordinary and something perhaps that's overlooked or taken for granted. I think it shouldn't be taken for granted. Okay, let's finish up this verse. Next value, vivikta. Desha sevatvam. Sevatvam, the state of resorting to a vivikta desha, a desha, a place which is vivikta, set apart, resorting to a solitary place. Now you're thinking, wait a minute, I live at home with a family in New Jersey, which is hardly a solitary place. So how am I going to find a solitary place living at home in New Jersey? I should go live in a cave. So clearly that's not what Sri Krishna is calling out here as a value. Tell me, in your home, no matter how many people live there, Is it possible to have a quiet corner? Vivikta-desha. That's all you need is a quiet corner in your room. When we teach in our meditation sessions, we often talk about the importance of having a place in your home set aside for prayer, for meditation, for spiritual study. That's all you need. You need a quiet corner, comfortable chair, reading lamp. What more do you need? A quiet corner. To not have that quiet corner is a mistake. Because what it means is whenever you're at home, you're caught up continually with all the commotion that goes on in every family, in every household. All kinds of things go on. So it's crucial that in your home, you should have a quiet corner set aside. And of course, you should go and sit there. Just to have, like, some people have a really elaborate prayer room and rarely use it. That's not very helpful. So you should, the prayer room is great. Go and sit there. That corner is crucial. Go and sit there at least once a day for 20 minutes. That's it. That quiet corner in your room, go and sit there at least once a day for 20 minutes. What you do in those 20 minutes is up to you. If you like to pray, if you like to do some meditation, if you like to do some spiritual study, if you just like to sit there and relax, just go and sit there for 20 minutes. Okay. And one more value. This is the 18th of the 20 values. I think it'll be the last one we see for today. Related also. Aratihi jana samsadi. Rati means fondness. Arati, absence of fondness. For what? Jana samsadi, groups of people. Now you're laughing because you think, who wants to be in groups of people? Most of us don't want to be in groups of people, and I understand that. But take it a little step further. And that is your family a group of people? Yeah? So this is related to the prior value. So at home, if you're continually engaged with your family, you're depriving yourself of an opportunity to just sit with yourself. Now, there are a lot of things going on at home, which is why it's so important to have that prayer room or that quiet corner where you can go for 20 minutes and just be with yourself. Again, if you like to do some prayers, some meditation, spiritual study, all of that is wonderful. But having that opportunity to just be with themselves. And it's significant that many people are actually disinclined to be with themselves. I have to tell you this anecdote because it shows so brilliantly. Some of you have heard me tell this anecdote. It's about my guru's first visit to this country. It was, I think, in 1976. I might have the date wrong. And he was on the phone with an airline. And they put him on hold and played some music. Now, in the 1970s, that was kind of a new thing, music on hold. And he had never, in India, it wasn't used at all then. So he's hearing this music on hold for the first time. And he says, he asked his host, why are they playing this music? And they said, oh, Swamiji, they do that so you won't get bored. And he said, without dropping a beat, he said, bored with whom? What an observation. When you're with yourself, you're bored. Bored with whom? Are you such bad company? You don't even enjoy your own company. It's a problem. And for some people, it's a big problem. Some people have so much hurt and resentment and frustration and anger that if they sit quietly, it all bubbles up. So they don't want to sit quietly. They want to be distracted. Decades ago, I visited my mother. In the other room, the television was on. I asked her, "Why do you have the television on?" And she said, "Oh, it keeps me company." Many people are like that. They want to be distracted. They don't want to sit with themselves because there's a lot of uncomfortable stuff inside that can bubble up. What to do? Deal with it. There are so many ways of dealing with all of that hurt and anger and frustration. Why should you carry it around with you your whole life? Earlier, we saw that value of shauchum, purity. And we're not talking about external purity. That's the easy part. This is the more important part, inner shaucha, inner purity. And that inner purity means to resolve all those unresolved emotional issues. If there is lingering hurt, lingering resentment, lingering anger or frustration, there's something that needs to be resolved. And the way you resolve it is not by distracting yourself. The way you resolve it is you find appropriate means, and there are so many. There are psychological techniques. Go to a bookstore and see how many self-help books are in that bookstore. Half the bookstore is filled with self-help books, and they're helpful. Nothing wrong with using self-help books. Nothing wrong with seeing a therapist. Nothing wrong with talking to a friend. Nothing wrong with praying about it, dealing with, taking it to Ishvara. Whatever modality works for you, however it helps you to deal with these unresolved emotional issues, do it. Why continue to carry that all around with you year after year? Better to confront it, deal with it in any appropriate way, then when you're sitting listening to the music on hold, you won't be bored. And you'll find that you are good company for yourself. Okay, we're still not done with the 20 values. We will finish that in our next class. Some announcements here. Tomorrow we have satsang at 6 p.m. I think we'll have to meet inside now. There's something important I want to ask you about. I mentioned last week that we have our Vedanta class restarted on Tuesday evenings. And I've noticed that the attendance is modest. I'm delighted to see so many of you here on Saturdays. The Tuesday class attendance is much less than it used to be. And there was a suggestion that came by email and made me realize that maybe Tuesday night is not an ideal time for class. Many of you are coming home from work. Also, especially in winter, it's dark and cold each night. So we are considering shifting the Vedanta class, which has been on Tuesday nights. We've done that for many, many years. But we're considering now to move it to Sundays at 11 o'clock. So instead of a 7:30 p.m. Tuesday Vedanta class, We're proposing to have our Vedanta class on Sundays at 11 a.m. I would like some feedback by a show of hands. How many people think it's a good idea? Okay, hands down, please. How many people think it's not such a good idea? Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And obviously, when it comes to timing, and what works for one person won't work for another. But it looks like for many people, there's a preference for Sundays. We will think about this, and we'll ask this again in Tuesday class, and then we'll make a decision about that. Thank you. Okay, we'll conclude with our brief prayers at the altar. Om Gananaham Tva Ganapatigam Vamahe Kavingavinamupamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahanashranvan Utabhasirasaranam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Guru Ratmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanuramardanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagadguru Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Hamritangamaya Om Shanti Shanti Shanti
Om Tat Sat.